And good morning, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Other Side of Midnight. That kind of, you know, the time after sunset and before dawn where we kind of give ourselves permission to think differently, to look at the world differently, to look at the universe differently, to look at our lives in a little different way. And that's what we're going to be doing this morning after I update you on something very interesting. As you know, in the last couple of weeks, there was a major news story all over the world about the LIGO network, which is the gravitational observatory, the gravitational observatory with two wings to it, two locations, one in near Hanford, Oregon, and the other in Louisiana. Well, a couple of weeks ago, from about 1.3 billion light years away, they have announced that they have found, finally, after over 100 years of Einstein's mathematical predictions, that they have in fact found the first gravitational waves. What I found for you tonight as part of getting ready for our LIGO gravitational wave show, we're still trying to find exactly the right person. What I found was an article in Forbes in the science section. Forbes, of course, is a major publication and has very high standards. And I want you to read it in your copious spare time before we actually do a show on this, or maybe two, because it's an excellent background as to what this detection, if it is confirmed, and again, we only have one so far, but this detection implies for the rest of Einstein's, you know, general theory of relativity. And the focus of this particular article is how, ultimately, the author, who himself is an astrophysicist, thinks that maybe this detection now will help unite the up-until-now separated worlds of the super-large and the super-small. In other words, cosmology, the structure of the universe, and quantum mechanics, the structure of atoms and subatomic particles involving things like quarks with charm and up and down. And anyway, if that's in fact what's ultimately going to happen, it will be an extraordinary breakthrough in science. And who knows, it may actually reveal surprises. That's part of the conversation we're going to have when we have the guest on that we're looking to have to talk about this incredibly interesting new development. So for those that do have copious spare time, go to othersideofmidnight.com, as you do every night. Click on the upper right-hand corner, Radio with Pictures. That takes you to tonight's guest page. And the first link is this very interesting Forbes article, which really lays out in a very clear fashion the history of the search for gravitational radiation and what it can mean in terms of ultimately uniting Einstein's relativity and quantum reality, or quantum theory, which is probably a more appropriate description. Moving on, tonight is kind of going to be a follow-on to last night. And I know a lot of you who have been reading the biography of my guest tonight are going to be scratching their heads and saying, what? How? Who? You'll see. Just stay tuned for the next 2 hours and you will see. My guest tonight is L.A. Marzulli, who is an author, a composer. Oh, we have no music. We've got to have music from him. We'll talk about that in a minute. And a researcher who had no use for God after the age of 13 when he stopped attending the Catholic Church of his parents. When he was 18, his 16-year-old girlfriend was killed in an accident. Deeply affected by this, he felt there was no God whatsoever. And to ease the pain, he sought relief from many sources, including, unfortunately, drugs. By the age of 21, Marzulli moved into an ashram. Although he'd left the church, he found himself drawn to other spiritual expressions, especially the New Age movement. His fascination with unusual phenomena drew him deeper and deeper into the supernatural and occultist world, and by the age of 30, he realized something crucial, that none of his experiences did a thing to change what was on the inside. Marzulli read a book by Dave Hunt, Kingdom of the Cultists, and started researching how many of today's phenomena have deep occultist roots. This research led him back to God and allowed him to heal from his past, and Marzulli then knew he had been deceived by an enemy. Marzulli's fascination with the enemy continued, but now for the whole new perspective. He sees the current fascination with UFOs and other unusual phenomena as tools of that enemy, and that the enemy is using to deceive people. It bothered him that Satan was deceiving so many, just as he had been deceived, so he wanted to warn others as to what was really happening and equip them to share their faith with those who were caught up in supernatural phenomena. He is the author and lecturer and filmmaker. He has penned 8 books now, including the Nephilim Trilogy, which made the CBA bestsellers list. He received an honorary doctorate for the series from his mentor, Dr. I.D. E. Thomas, who at the time was provost at Pacific International University. His new series, On the Trail of the Nephilim, is a full-color, oversized book which uncovers startling evidence that there has been a massive cover-up of what he believes are the remains of the Nephilim, the giants mentioned in the Bible. He is now working on Volume 2 in the series, which promises to have an even more incredible and revealing set of images and interviews. L.A. is on the trail. So without further ado, good morning and welcome to The Other Side of Midnight, L.A.
Great to be here, Richard. Thanks for having me on.
Well, this is going to be really interesting because I agree with almost none of what you said, except you were a good Catholic. And I'm going to, we're going to have a fun time this morning because yesterday, since you didn't follow the show, let me tell you what we did. Yesterday, I had my imaging team on, who are a group of independent specialists scattered around the country. In fact, there are other people that are working with us who are scattered around the world. And we're looking at imagery, space imagery from the various space agencies of the various governments that are sending spacecraft all around the solar system. And what we discussed last night as part of a continuing series of programs is additional evidence in the form of official imagery from these space agencies, from these robotic spacecraft, that in fact, in this solar system, we are not the first. We are surrounded by an astonishing set of ancient ruins, really, really, really ancient ruins. And the major question is, not are they there, because the data now is overwhelming. The question, of course, is who built them? And from my perspective, I'm going to say I think it might have been the Nephilim, your Nephilim. So that's where our conversation is going to be joined tonight. And with that, let me start with another question. One of your books, I think, had to do with politics and the occult or the supernatural. Is that correct?
Politics, prophecy, and the supernatural.
Ah, because I'm looking at this electoral season, and I'm saying if we only are judging by the current political scene, we are definitely in the end times. What do you think?
Well, I mean, absolutely. If we look at what's happening on a global level, and we could do a very short trip around the planet. In fact, when I'm lecturing at places and conferences, I'll ask the audience, how many of you think that the world is a safer place and that your lives are better than what they were 15 years ago? There's not a hand that goes up, not one. Mm-hmm. And I've done this over and over and over again. People feel it in their guts. It's visceral. It's primal. They know something is wrong. Some people will articulate it. Other people don't want to deal with it and will medicate with either, you know, sports or getting involved in something or, you know, whatever it is to avoid really what's looking at it. I mean, just look at Fukushima, and I know you're up with all that, but it's an ongoing extinction level event, and there's no end in sight with it. And God forbid we should have another 9.0 earthquake off the Fukushima prefecture in Japan, and those things go sliding into the ocean. Now what? And of course, we look at the Middle East. You know, people talk about the blood moons, and I get a lot of questions for people asking, you know, well, nothing really happened with the 4 blood moons last year. And I say, well, what did you want? The planet to split in half? The bottom line is everything. We have unprecedented events happening last year at the tail end of 2015. For starters, the Russians moved an entire army into the Middle East. Unprecedented. The second unprecedented event was over 1 million so-called refugees, which people are now calling an invasion force, hello, went into Europe. What Charles Martel held back at the Battle of Tours and later on at the gates of Vienna, just completely overrun. And Merkel is basically committing national suicide. Then you got the Iranians who were launching, you know, two rockets, which completely nixes the so-called deal with death to Israel written on the side of the rockets. I mean, it's just bananas. And then, of course, you look at the BRICS nations, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, desperately trying to move the world default currency from the petrodollar to the Chinese yuan. And this is why gas and oil is so cheap right now. Russia is the second largest exporter of oil on the planet, and that's how they're getting whacked. Meanwhile, the Iranians are trading their oil for euros, which is a no-no. You can't do that. That's actually what got Saddam whacked. I mean, we could talk about this stuff all night. The political intrigue is really through the roof, and I think that we are in the beginnings of World War III.
Hmm. Okay, that's the good news. Now, what's the bad news? I'm serious. You know, these things have been going on, well, for as long as I've been alive. I remember duck and cover. I remember when I used to huddle under my desk and say, how can this stupid thing protect me? You know, and I happened to see Dr. Strangelove the other night, and it brought back all kinds of horrible memories. And we survived. We're still here, and we actually got the Russians to back down without firing a single nuclear shot through something which I know is a little strange to a lot of folks these days, called diplomacy. There was a guy named Kennedy who really believed he could actually talk to the Russians at a time when even thinking of talking to the Russians ultimately got him killed. But what he left in his wake as a legacy is where we talk to each other. We actually have dismantled warheads. We've chopped them up together. We have reduced the threat of accidental nuclear annihilation by several degrees. But, you know, politics in life is not a constant. It's a constantly evolving process. So, yes, there are ups and downs. But I would argue that things are not really worse than they were in the 50s when I was growing up and you were growing up. They're actually a lot better because there's very few things on Earth now that can kill all of us or even a tiny fraction of us, even though the news media give us 24/7 of the drumbeat that life is awful and awful and horrible and we're about to die in our beds. And it's not true. Even in the most catastrophic event in modern American history, 9/11, only, and I use that term in quotes, 3,000 people died. About the same number as died at Pearl Harbor. The difference was, of course, the Pearl Harbor victims were military. They had volunteered. They were part of the American warfighting force there in the Pacific. And the folks that died in 9/11 were all civilians. But look at what Curtis LeMay did to civilians on behalf of the American people in World War II. He carpet bombed. He firebombed, you know, Tokyo to where, and Dresden, and, you know, there's a whole bunch of other places. So when I look at the world, yeah, there's some really bad actors, there's some really bad things, but the trend curve actually is getting better for our overall survival if we simply pay attention now to the details and understand why there are these really bad things happening, but on a much more localized level.
Well, I would respectfully disagree. You've got, first of all, you've got an abortion holocaust, where you've got over 1 billion babies worldwide. That's 1 billion babies killed. And, you know, people LA, can disagree LA. On that or look at the numbers, but that's a fact.
Okay, L.A.
That's an unprecedented event.
L.A., do you believe in reincarnation?
No.
Why not?
Well, I don't think there's any. First of all, there's no proof for it. Second of all,
if there is reincarnation,
who's keeping tabs on it?
You just said there's no proof. I can give you all kinds of studies, starting at the University of Virginia. I forget the doctor's name. I think his name is Dickinson, who's gone to India, has made extraordinary, extensive, decades-long studies, and has found example after example after example that the only rational explanation is whoever came back remembers a previous life, and they can go to their old home, and they can find stuff they buried. And how do they do that if there's not a real possibility that that, in fact, is real data?
Well, there's basically another alternative to that, and I've argued that with people before.
Which is?
And I'd have to look at it case by case and see what the background of the family is. But the people that I've dealt with that have had those memories, there's usually what is known as a familiar spirit, which is attached to the family or is attached to the person. And that's where the memory comes from. In other words, there are entities which I believe have been on this planet for millennia. and continue to do so. So the whole idea, just because information is given to some person or a person has a thought about someone else's former life, doesn't mean that they were reincarnated or that that was that person. That just means that they're getting a thought, or and it could even mean like buried items, like you were saying. I mean, entities that are around will seek to do this because it's all about deception.
Okay, it's all about deception. What does in this corporate entity gain by you know, confusing or deceiving an 11-year-old or a 5-year-old Indian kid, you know, in India, to make him think that he had lived as a guy before in a you know, a street 20 miles away where he couldn't even walk? What's the point of the deception?
Well, it promulgates the whole idea of reincarnation, which I think is a hopeless, absolutely hopeless system to be under.
Okay.
There certainly is no grace and mercy with reincarnation, and it's a works trip. You have to somehow evolve to the point where, you know, you don't come back anymore, or you transcend this level. And look, I was with a guru, my third eye was open and the whole deal. And I was there for like 3 or 4 years.
In the ashram, I mean.
In the ashram, I experienced, you know, all sorts of supernatural events. And so I've been on both sides of the aisle.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, I believed, like many people do, in reincarnation. I've changed my paradigm. I've changed the way I look at the world. I think reincarnation is a hopeless system. And it also begs the question, who is looking at all this and keeping track of who's doing what? And then, well, you know, you didn't make it this time, so you've got to come back as a whatever, a giraffe, or, you know, whatever you're going to come back as. I mean, how does that work? And so the idea of...
Well, are we mixing two metaphors here? Reincarnation as humans again and again and again is different from souls reincarnating as giraffes and tigers and lions and bears.
I'm being tongue-in-cheek, but I mean, the bottom line is human beings reincarnating endlessly in endless cycles, I think, is just an incredible, hopeless paradigm to embrace.
Decades ago, when I was starting my own kind of research path in this area, I met someone, I'm not going to mention his name, he's quite well known, who insisted, with pretty interesting background, that he remembered reincarnating here from another world, from another star system, from another species. And I presume you also think that's a deception.
Well, I mean, you know, it's a loaded question, but the bottom answer to that is yes, I do. You know, now near-death experiences, that's something else altogether again. That I do believe in. And we've interviewed people. I've also had a near-death experience myself when I was around 21 years old. And I have been taken out of this body since I became a born-again, spirit-filled Christian, which might get the hairs on people's back, you know, riled up a little bit. But it's happened to me twice. And I was completely, fully conscious when it happened. I was taken to a future time for about 3 seconds, which jibes with the biblical prophetic narrative, which were incredible experiences. But they only lasted a very short time, and I was shown something, and then, bam, I'm back.
Mm-hmm.
And there's precedent for that in the biblical narrative. Other people have had the same type of thing. So it's nothing certainly unique to me. However, it's rare. It's 2 times in 36 years.
That is kind of beating the percentages. I'm kind of glad you came back, because otherwise we couldn't have this conversation. If I'm not being too personal, why did you leave the ashram?
Well, after, you know, 3 years or 4 years of meditating and doing everything, now I wouldn't be able to articulate what I'm about to say back then. I wouldn't be able to put it and couch it in the terms I'll present it to you with tonight. But the bottom line for me was this, that, and it happened in let me see, what was it, 74. We were in Houston getting ready to do this big Houston Astrodome thing, which was sort of a flop, by the way. And I remember waking up at 2 a.m. or thereabouts and realizing that I had given all my possessions away. I had joined the ashram. I was meditating for hours every day. All this stuff, you know, third eye open, divine nectar, divine music, all this stuff, experiencing it. But inwardly, nothing had changed. Inwardly, the inner man, nothing had changed. All it did was mask my own depravity. Now, I wouldn't put it in terms back then and calling it my own depravity. But, you know, I'm 65 years old, and I can look back and say, and state with great emphasis, that's exactly what I was wrestling with, because that depravity that I believe, in fact, is in every human being on the planet, in greater or lesser extents, and we've learned to control it, we learn to mask it, we learn to live with it, but it's always there on some level, and that's what I was wrestling with, and I wouldn't be able to deal with that, or there wasn't a system to deal with that that I even knew about and didn't discover till like 6 years later.
Who was your guru?
Maharaji.
Okay, I'm not. There's a number of them. You know, I'm familiar with, you know, more recent ones like Sai Baba, and I'm familiar with the ones in the 1800s, who was a guru to the very famous guru who lived in Santa Barbara, but I'm not familiar.
Krishnamurti.
Krishnamurti was one of them. Yeah. Okay. So you basically had kind of an epiphany. You had a moment of enlightenment when you said, this is not satisfying my inner me. So then you went looking.
Actually, I became an agnostic.
Okay.
I basically had it with everything and just didn't want to be bothered in exploring anymore. You know, not only did I do the guru stuff, but I did the Carlos Castaneda, you know, Little Smoke and looking for spirit guides and contacted spirit guides. I mean, I could tell you one story, for instance, you know, I just had one hit of very, very potent marijuana. And this is like, you know, 40 years ago or something. Mm-hmm. And I haven't done anything like that in 36 years and you couldn't pay me to do it again. But I used it strictly in a Carlos Castaneda-like way, if I can use that term. And I would go into the chaparral in the mountains and wait and meditate. And one day, one night, I was doing this, and I heard this rattle in front of me. Now, remember, I'm all alone in the chaparral. There's no one around me. I'm on some little, you know, little trail someplace.
You're in the high desert. It's after sunset.
Yeah,
you're
yeah.
cold.
Well, it wasn't cold, but it doesn't matter.
Okay.
I'm sitting there cross-legged, and in front of me, I hear this rattle like, shh.
Oh.
And I'm going,
that sound.
Weird. Yeah, that's bizarre. And then, you know, to the right, shh.
Uh-oh.
And then behind me,
shh. Oh, you're kidding.
No. And I'm all alone, and I have the thought that comes into my head. And this is what I mean by, look, off-world entities, let's call them extraterrestrials because that's what they are. They can put things in your head. I know it sounds crazy, but suggestions, if you're open through pharmakia, drug taking, then you're susceptible to that. That's why the Mahatmas and the holy men in India, they're hash heads.
You're susceptible or you're more susceptible?
You're more susceptible.
Okay.
More susceptible. And so I'm sitting there, and then it's to the left of me, shh, and it's getting closer every time I hear this thing.
Mm.
And I'm by this time it's dark, and I'm freaking out because I know there's an entity. I don't know what it is. And the thought comes in that everything is one, and that if everything is one and everything is connected, then there's no fear.
Mm-hmm.
That and if God is in everything, then everything is God. Then you are God. All that whole type of deal came in. And, okay, that's interesting. And I'm sitting there, and this thing comes at me. And remember, I'm sitting cross-legged on the ground, and it pushes my back at about a 45-degree angle. You can't do that. Well, maybe, you know, if you have someone hold you, you can lean back to you're about, you know, 45 degrees. Mm-hmm. So your legs are in front of you, cross-legged, and this thing just pushed me back and held me there. And at that point, I broke free, took my hand, and started slapping my thigh. This was a technique that I had learned in, you know, A Yaki Way of Knowledge by Carlos Castaneda, and the thing left. So that's just one experience from the other side, as it were, with what I would call a spirit guide.
Fascinating. So how did that trigger your return to Christianity?
Well, the return to Christianity was a very reluctant one. I mean, I was not going to church. I was not, you know, people had been telling me about Yeshua, but I wasn't interested. I mean, I just used to look at it and absolutely laugh and scoff, and because I had no idea what it was. And it's like, unless a person, see, here's the deal. A lot of people think that what they think they know who Yeshua is, but they don't know him. So if you don't know him, you don't know him. That's the bottom line. And I thought I knew him, but of course I didn't know him. And I was reading this book by Dave Hunt, and it was like a little punch list, and reading about the kingdom of the cults and going, yeah, I've been in that one. Yeah, I've tried this, did that, you know, that type of thing. Looked at this, explored that. And at the end, there's this little prayer thing, and I'm all alone. And it's actually the place I'm in my studio here. This was the guest house. So I was living in the guest house, and about 5 feet from where I'm sitting right now, there was a chair, and I was just all alone. No pressure. No one's around. And I just said a little prayer. I said, look, I don't know whether you're alive or you're real or you are who these people say you are, but if you are, come into my life and change it. And everything started to unravel. And that's 36 years ago.
So by giving up and giving in and removing your ego, something came in and began to shift for you.
You could look at it that way. That's sort of a fair analysis.
When you say unravel, what do you mean by unravel? Because unravel has a kind of a negative connotation.
Well, the life I had been leading began to unravel. My girlfriend moved out promptly. Everything changed. I mean, the life I led unraveled. I mean, it changed. Oh, not overnight. Well, yeah, overnight, and then it continued. And look, I had two mentors within 24 hours once it hit. And I mean, I was being dragged out of one kingdom into another. And the warfare, the spiritual warfare that was happening at the time was very, very intense. And it was a time in my life where I really wouldn't wish on pretty much anyone. I mean, it was just very, very difficult to go through. Because remember, in my opinion, and looking back at it now, taking these type of drugs is actually called pharmakia. And we know from ancient manuscripts that pharmakia is akin to witchcraft, because what it does is it opens a person up. And that's fine. It opens you up. But where do you get opened to? Mm-hmm. A good analogy or a good topic, or not topic, but something to point to, which is a fascinating book by Graham Hancock, Supernatural. And he's out there taking ayahuasca.
Mm.
Very, very powerful drug. And he's being catapulted into another place. And at the end of the book, and he's trying to, you know, trying to grapple with this and figure out what is happening to me? Where am I going? Why am I seeing grays, the gray aliens, which are now enculturated and so popular, and even at the Super Bowl, they show them, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he's there and he's seeing these entities, and he doesn't know idea why they're there. And even, in fact, where he is. But at the end of the book, he says something which is very telling. And this brings us, of course, back to the Nephilim, full circle. He says that whatever these entities are, they seem obsessed with creating some sort of a hybrid being with us. And that is part of what I do. That's part of what our research is. And not switching topics, but sort of adding to it. When we took out the implant from a man who had been abducted, and this was with the late Dr. Roger Lehr, who was in all of our Watchers series. There was 9 installments.
I'll tell you what, that is kind of a departure, so let's hold that to the other side of the break.
Okay.
My guest this morning is L.A. Marzullo. Well, I don't want to truncate interesting things because there are connections here. My guest this morning, L.A. Marzullo, who describes himself as a frank supernaturalist. I'm kind of going to ask what a frank supernaturalist is. Who, of course, has now looked into UFOs, the Nephilim, and ancient prophetic texts. And we're going to get to all of that as soon as we come back. You're on the other side of midnight. This is our old friend Bobby Bright. From the other side of the planet, I kind of gave him short shrift this week, hit the wrong switch. This is to make up for it, Bobby. Thank you for your music. I really enjoy it. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. Again, you're on the other side of midnight, and we shall return.
Confuse me when they ought to be clear. It ain't appealing, this feeling, paying for my younger days. you. Didn't know what I was doing when I did it. Ain't that the truth? Now there's aches and there's pains.
And we are back on the other side of midnight. Oh, by the way, if you do go back to othersideofmidnight.com, we apparently now, because of the wonderful efforts of Keith Rowland, actually got some of L.A.'s music posted on the site. Oh, there it is. Wow. In fact, I'll tell you what, why don't we give a listen? Because this might be interesting. What do you think? L.A.?
Yeah, which one are you listening to? What are you listening to?
It says Twin Towers Tribute.
Yeah, it's kind of lengthy, but it's a fully orchestrated piece.
Okay. Well, we can always dump out of it when we
want to.
Let's see what it sounds like. I mean, I always like to see people with more than one talent because the world is not, one note. Let's see. I think I'm doing this correctly. No, I don't think that's it.
No, that's not it.
No, not at all. Here we are. Here we are. Did you do the orchestration?
Yeah.
Wow.
Composed, orchestrated, and recorded.
Oh, this is very impressive.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
This is cool. Who did the recording?
I recorded in my recording studio, which I had at the time.
Oh, so you multi-layered tracks and all that.
Yep.
Oh my, this is amazing. And you have to see the pictures, folks. Other Side of Midnight, Radio with Pictures. Click on the link, and this is very impressive. You got to see this with the pictures, folks. You really do. And again, go to the website, othersideofmidnight.com, and there it is. Okay, let's segue into the whole Nephilim thing, because when you say we're being deceived, am I correct in thinking that those are the folks that have been deceiving us?
Well, let me put it to you this way, and if you look at the first picture. And I'll go somewhere with this, I promise you. And I know you've been to some of these sites.
Yes, like, I've measured them. Okay, yeah, so let's go to Radio with Pictures and look at number one, which looks like Sacsayhuaman. Is that it?
That's it. That's Sacsayhuaman.
Okay. And link number one. Click on it. And, oh, wow. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, Sacsayhuaman, when you're there, and, you know, I visited there. Brian Forrester took me. And the crew, we filmed there. It's Watcher 6. And immediately, we're in the Neolithic. at least archaeologists believe that the wall was constructed in the Neolithic. And unfortunately, there were no iron tools in the Neolithic. And you can't cut andesite stone with copper chisels. Which
now, describe how hard andesite is.
Andesite, diamond is 10 on a Mohs hardness. And andesite is about 7 on a Mohs hardness scale. And it's just, not only that, when we look at the polygonal shapes of Sacsayhuaman, of those stones, and some of these stones weigh upwards of 120 tons. And it begs the question, I mean, how did they do this? And it's ashlar construction. And ashlar construction is construction of stone without mortar. There's no mortar used here. And we know from the remnants of this that the sides are highly polished. And when you, I've asked archaeologists, I've asked architects, I've taken this to engineers, and everybody kind of shrugs and starts laughing nervously. And I've come to call this fallen angel technology, Nephilim architecture. And I want to clarify something here, because that when I say fallen angels, people have a preconceived notion. I'm not talking about some little cherub thing, you know, little wings flying around here. I'm talking about entities that when they show up, people basically short circuit and do a face plant. That's what happens. When a guy saw in 1967, saw the Mothman, and I interviewed this guy, it's in my book, Further Evidence. This guy was heard about the Mothman, and he figured it was, well, you know, it sounds pretty evil. And that's what he thought it was, okay? Mm-hmm. So he goes to bed one night, and he's got this weird feeling when he walks in the house and has dinner with his wife. Now it's like 2:30 in the morning. He wakes up, rolls over, and looks at the foot of the bed. Guess who's standing there? And this thing's about 7 to 8 feet tall, dark black wings. It's got... its neck is like, you know, its head is like shrunk down into its shoulders. It's got a cape on. And this guy was completely, utterly paralyzed. He could not move at all. And I asked him, I said, what was it like? And he described it in one word, wickedness. That's what he described it as, wickedness. Mm-hmm. And he's the only man I've ever met and talked to out of the witnesses I've talked to with Mothman that actually had some sort of victory over this thing. And he had the victory over it, and the thing vanished and left. And maybe a little bit later on, I'll tell you how he did that.
I was just going to say, what did he do? Don't wait. Tell us.
Well, I'll wait. It's good radio to let people
okay.
wait.
Okay. All right.
But I'll promise I'll get back to it. The bottom line is, this entity had the ability to appear in the room and then disappear. And what's interesting is that the same when we go to Sacsayhuaman and we look at the rocks, mm-hmm. there is technology there that we would, frankly, in my opinion, we would be hard pressed to duplicate today.
Are you
cranes, are lasers, you, diamond saws? Could we do it?
Are you aware of the famous statement by Arthur C. Clarke? Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic.
I agree. Yeah. Okay.
So just because this guy bopped in and bopped out of this guy's room doesn't mean it was supernatural. It just could have been a really interesting transporter.
Well, let's define our terms. From my point of view, he's breaking every law of physics that we know of, but that's okay. Mm-hmm. So I will call that supernatural, and because it's certainly not natural. It defies all of our laws of physics.
Yeah, but we're primitives. We're barely climbed up, you know, out of the slime, you know, to use an ancient expression. There's an awful lot left that we don't know, and there's some things that the secret guys know that the rest of us don't know. So to basically define natural and supernatural based on our certain current, you know, primitive ideas of how things work, is that kind of fair?
Well, I think it is. Because, again, we've got stories like this from the biblical prophetic narrative, which talks about these entities and what they are and what they did. I think that Sacsayhuaman is a pre-flood structure. I think you hold this view, too, that there was a worldwide flood. Every culture on the planet has stories of the flood, and they all sound very similar. Something was going on here. And
well, I have my own, you know, physical ideas as to what caused, quote, the flood. I don't think it's the traditional... shall we say Christian perspective, you know, fundamental Christian perspective. I think that the
which is what, by the way, what do you think that the fundamental Christian perspective is?
Well, that there was this canopy, vapor canopy, and something broke it, and you had this incredible deluge, and it also says in Genesis, you know, the fountains of the earth erupted, and the fountains of the deep. I think that, in fact, the world tipped over, And because we're on a world with a lot of water called oceans, when you tip the planet over, you get what I call the bathtub effect. You get a slosh. You get tidal waves miles high, and they scour everything. And that, of course, was, quote, the flood. At least that's our model.
Yeah, pole shift. Let me ask you this. What was the reason for the flood? Why did the flood come?
Oh, because, well, in our model, the physics got out of resonance. Or someone wanted to do us in, and they tweaked the physics in a way that would make it look like it was totally natural. Look, Ma, no fingerprints.
See, this is what most people don't understand. From my point of view, what I think the reason for the flood was, it goes back into Genesis 3. We're not going to have an in-depth Bible study. We're just going to talk about it. The bottom line is this. We hear that a mandate comes down, and it says, the seed of the serpent will be at enmity with the seed of the woman. Mm-hmm. That's what it says. The seed of the woman eventually becomes Messiah thousands of years later. That's what Christians believe. Okay, so the seed of the woman becomes Messiah. The seed of the serpent.
Ah, who is that?
Erupts in Genesis 6. And the seed of the serpent is the cohabitation of the fallen angelic host, i.e. supernatural beings, extraterrestrials, because they are not from here. So in a classic sense, they are, in fact, extraterrestrials.
Right.
These entities that come to Earth, they see the women, they marry the women, and the offspring is known as the Nephilim. And what's interesting is it's not a weekend frat party. And I know you knew the late David Flynn. David and I
talked
on not numerous occasions, but on several occasions.
David had such a brilliant mind. And
he was incredible.
It, such a tragedy he was taken too soon.
It's
because
hard to believe.
What he would do with what we now have assembled. Because remember, he did a book on Sidonia. He did a book on our research.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I invited him to conferences. He got better and better at conferences. He had such a long runway, and it was so cut short so tragically. But his idea...
We all miss him.
Go ahead.
Yeah, we all miss him. Yes. But David and I conversed about the Nephilim and the flood and all of this. And what people don't realize, it wasn't like a weekend frat party. They were here for 450 years. That's a long time. And we believe that, and again, this is from the ancient book of Enoch, which is found in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Quoted from the ancient Jewish historian Josephus, and on it goes.
Yeah, not part of the current canon of the Old and New Testament.
But we can certainly appreciate its historicity. And what's interesting here is when we look at what the Book of Enoch tells us about these extraterrestrials who come, it says verbatim here, they share the secrets of heaven. And there's all these different, there's a list of what they give to mankind. And so when I look at Sacsayhuamam, in my opinion, because when the conquistadors showed up there, they asked the Inca who built Sacsayhuamam. The Inca just said the giants built them. It was here when we got here. And we hear this even by the Native Americans with the Great Circle Mountain in Ohio, which is number 6. We'll get there eventually. But the bottom line is I've come to call this fallen angel technology, Nephilim architecture. And you're right. There is technology which to us looks like magic because we don't understand the physics behind it. But it's not magic. But these entities, in my opinion, can manipulate time, space, and matter and energy in ways that we can't.
Well, the ways you and I can't, but there are guys on this planet who are using that same technology for very dark purposes in the so-called black ops world.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so the technology is known. The physics is known. It's just been suppressed from all the rest of us because it's not being used for light. It's not being used to help humankind. It's being used now by our oppressors to oppress us.
And to enslave us eventually, yes.
So we're on the same page there. I guess I would just quibble with the term because I don't think of these guys as angels. I just think of them as extraterrestrials.
We are so close, you have no idea how really close we are. Mm. All you've got to do is change some verbiage, and we're on the same page because we know that there's an outside agency that's messing with us.
Well, hang on. You say you know. I don't know that yet because I'm trying to figure it out. I'm very big on trying to figure things out. I do not take source information lightly because sources can always be twisted or manipulated or, you know, filtered or censored or whatever. So I try to go back to data and kind of meld independent data to come up with a consensus because that's what science is. So we're going to run out of time, and I don't want to run out of time before we get to some really important stuff. So let's go through the images. What's number 2? It looks like a quarry.
No, that's Ollantaytambo. Again,
that's right. I just clicked on it.
It's in Peru, and you can see the steps on the far right-hand side, and the steps go way up. They call it the Temple of the Sun, but of course, no one knows what this was. No one knows who built it, how they built it. Again, we see these megalithic stones weighing, you know, hundreds of tons.
Where is this located?
I'm sorry, what?
Where is this located?
It's in Peru.
Peru, okay. Up in the Andes.
It's in a place called the Sacred Valley in Peru. And it's just, when I was there, just my jaw hit the ground because I realized that you can see right there in the site, you can see the original builders and then the Inca come in, perhaps thousands of years later, and they use indigenous rocks. The rocks here, once again, are andesite, quarried miles away, and then brought here. How was it brought here? What's interesting also, going back to one real quick, was the quarry in Sacsayhuamán. Mm-hmm. The quarry in Sacsayhuamán is a good distance away from the site, like 40 miles away. Mm. And Brian Forrest is telling me he was there. You can only get there by horseback, you finally arrive at the quarry, and this is what's weird. All the blocks were taken up, and the quarry faced like 50, 100 feet up. So it's like, wait a minute, how did that work? So
have you? That's astonishing. Stuff. Have you been to Baalbek?
Oh, now you're hitting me below the belt.
That's a place I want to go.
Do that.
Well,
I can't wait to go to Baalbek. Yeah. But it's so. Brian was there last year.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
I didn't know Brian was able to get in there. Because I wanted to go in there, and when you kind of look at what's going on.
Oh, Richard, I'd give anything to go to Baalbek. Did you hear about the two new stones that they discovered last year?
I saw one somewhere on the internet a couple of days ago.
It's bigger than the Stone of the Pregnant Women.
Which is 1,400 tons.
They're saying this one's about 1,800 tons.
Oh, my gosh.
I know. Hmm. And you can't do that.
Well, we can't do that.
We can't do
yet.
That. Yeah, and,
remember,
and
the Black Ops guys
can. Why get up on a Monday morning and do it to begin with?
Mm. Okay, so number two is up. How far are these two sites separated, Sacsayhuamán and Mount?
Well, Sacsayhuamán's in Cusco, and Ollantaytambo is in the Sacred Valley. It's a good, maybe, I'm trying to think here, 4 or 5 hours, 5 hours.
Okay, flying time? Or
no,
driving time. Driving time.
We actually drove from Cusco.
Okay, so are you saying these are the same guys, the same culture?
Good question. In my opinion, yes.
Okay. All right. Number three is very familiar.
Pyramid of Giza.
Yep.
And I do not believe, and I don't think you believe it either, that this was a tomb.
Oh, no. No.
Yeah. It's just, I think it was some sort of power plant.
Do you know Chris Dunn's work, speaking of power plants?
I know who he is, right. Okay.
Might be fun to have you guys on together, because Chris Dunn is firmly of the opinion he has found, it's not just an opinion, I mean, the data's there, he's found stunning, incredible high-tech evidence of machining, of super technology, of cutting fragile materials without cracking, without glazing. In other words, some high technology is visible, and the pyramids, to our perspective, his and mine, are the biggest example of a super high-tech technology doing this stuff. Ancient Egyptians did not.
I agree. I completely concur with that. I'm not sure what it was. I lean towards some sort of a power plant with all the tunnel network that's underneath the pyramids. It was deliberate, and you're right. Talking about, look, How to go back to Sacsayhuamán, Ollantaytambo, number three, the Great Pyramid. How do you quarry these stones? And this is the enigma. Just show me this. If you just show me this, then I'll believe the Zawi Hawass nonsense. With respect to Mr. Hawass. All right? Just show me how you take granite blocks from Aswan, 500 miles away, the size of railroad cars, and move them down the Nile and then set them above the King's Chamber in the Neolithic. Just show me that.
70 tons
apiece.
The
heck with the stones and everything else. Fine, Zowie, you know, the Egyptians did it. Just show me how you move the granite, how you cut the granite, how you dress the granite, and how you got it down there. And I know you can't do it because it can't be done.
Do you remember a TV special some years ago where the Japanese came in and
actually tried
to build a little?
I used that. Yeah, it was hysterical.
Oh, absolutely! It's kind of almost like a Keystone Cops.
Exactly what it was. It was hysterical, and they told to go home.
So, okay, why, if all this evidence is kind of staring us in the face,
yes,
why does academia en masse all over this planet basically tell folks that you and I are nuts?
You know, I have my theories on that, but it's beginning to change, and it goes back into the Darwinian paradigm. This is my own theory with it, and you've asked, and so I'll tell you what I think. You know, Darwinism is sacrosanct. It tells us, and you mentioned it, you know, millions of years of just evolution, which I don't believe in either. And the only reason why I don't believe in it, because the deoxyribonucleic DNA molecular structure, when Crick found that, he was a vexed man because he realized that, and I use this quote, that all the prebiotic slime over millions of years would never assemble by random chance just one string of protein. So when Ben Stein in his movie Expelled, No Intelligence Allowed, sits down with Richard Dawkins, who, by the way, as we both know, is one of the premier evolutionists of the 21st century. Stein asks him a question. Where did the first self-replicating molecule come from? And he's right. No one knows. I don't know. Stein doesn't know, and Dawkins, and no one knows where it came from, okay? But it somehow got here. So he throws him an intellectual lifeline. Stein throws Dawkins an intellectual lifeline. He says, well, how do you think life began? And this is what Dawkins has to offer, and it's basically panspermia. And he says, well, maybe a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, a race of extraterrestrials who would have had to have risen by, you know, to some high level of civilization by some sort of Darwinian process created us in a lab and seeded us here. That's panspermia. That's what he believes.
But that's only kicking the can down the road.
That's kicking the can way down the road. And
or back up the road.
And what's interesting is, and this is where faith and science sort of intersect or perhaps part company, I don't know. Again, the biblical narrative states, and this is from our point of view, and I'll use your terms, magic. It says that Yeshua created everything ex nihilo, from nothing. And if the biblical narrative is correct and true, just give you one example. When there's 5,000 people sitting there and they haven't eaten all day, the disciples come to them and say, hey, the people are hungry. What do you, you know, what do we got? And Yeshua takes the bread. Most of us know the story, but we fail to see the absolute and marvel at it. Wait a minute. He's producing full-grown fish from nothing. Mm-hmm. How does that work?
Well, you don't have to explain a miracle. Come on.
Well, but
or
is it a miracle or is it some outside science that's doing it?
Or a replicator from Star Trek.
Well,
in other words, exactly. A really advanced technology which can actually take matter from the ether, from the torsion field, and assemble it into anything you want.
I think he did it without the machine.
Okay. But, you know, as I said to a friend of mine decades ago when I invited her to, she was a specialist in anthropology in Peru, oddly enough. Oh. I said, but what you're describing, even though it doesn't fit our terms of a technology, is really a technology. So a conscious technology is still a technology.
I agree with you. Here's something to think about. We know that the New Jerusalem comes down at the end of 1,000 years.
Now, this is huge, big flying city.
Yeah, this is a big flying city. Now, how does that work? How does the 1,500-mile-wide city float down? Where does it come from? And by the way, who's building it?
Mm.
And how does it work? And of course, we know nothing about that. We know nothing about it.
Well, as said in Independence Day, we do. We've been looking at the ruins all over the solar system of an incredibly advanced ancient civilization. Really, really ancient.
Why were the ruins there?
All over the solar system? Because they remodeled the solar system. And we, in this model, could have been an experiment. An experiment maybe in free will. And boy, did we blow it. Because if our reconstructions are even approximately accurate, we have been doing these same stupid things, blowing each other up, hating each other, dividing each other, you know, being terrified of each other to the point of obsession for millions of years. We've almost learned nothing.
What if the ruins that we see are the remnants of a galactic war, a heavenly war, that spilled out into this dimension? And that happened, who knows, you know, how long ago. I won't put a date on it. But in the far distant past.
Well, again, we're not that far apart because we're not looking at a galactic. Although, actually, you'd bring up an interesting point. There is some evidence now that this galactic feud, that we're kind of being caught up in it again, kind of at the edges. You know, Roddenberry, when he did Star Trek, he did one show, I very remember, of the Yangs and the Coms.
I remember that, yeah.
And it turns out that it was the Yankees and the Communists, and it was a replication of the Cold War, America, Russia, US, Soviet Union, all that, set in some far distant planet, like a independent, evolved template. If, in fact, we're part of some much larger soap opera, some much larger conflict, and what really goes on here is not the centerpiece, it's just kind of at the edges, kind of like Vietnam was at the edges of the huge conflict between us and the Soviet Union, that could explain a lot of the stuff we're seeing. But again, we need to find real data. We need to find, as I say again and again and again, the libraries. And I think they're within reach with this technology in this solar system. All we have to do is have an honest set of space programs or a private effort, which can't be controlled. And someday we will find them, and then we'll have, as Paul Harvey used to say, the rest of the story. Anyway, hold it there. We're at the bottom of the hour. Actually, we're at the top of the hour. Got to get that clock moved over to where my window is, but that would ruin my view of the Sandias. My guest this morning is L.A. Marzulli, and we are discussing all kinds of interesting stuff about who are we really, and what are we doing in this place, and who may have been messing with us. This is another cut from our friend Bobby Bright. You're on the other side of midnight, and we shall return.
Got a long list of things I have to reappraise. There's things I don't see, things I don't hear, and simple things confuse me when they ought to be clear. It ain't appealing, it's really paying for my younger days. Well, I'm paying through the nose for the good times.
And we are back on the other side of midnight. It's about, it's in the upper 30s tonight. It's getting chilly out there. I thought summer was here. It was gorgeous today. And in the desert at night, without much water vapor, it gets really chilly. Okay, L.A., you believe we have evidence right in front of us here in the Americas of the Nephilim presence. Where and how and why?
Well, let's just go to Catalina Island, which is the basis. A lot of that research went into the book On the Trail of the Nephilim, Volume 2. The backstory on that, which is sort of fascinating, is a guy by the name of Jim Watson who wrote a book called Mysterious Catalina. And I read the book, and in it he talks about Ralph Glidden, at the turn of the last century, around 1919, was employed by the High Museum to go and conduct what were, by any standards, primitive archaeological digs all around the Channel Islands. The Channel Islands go from Santa Barbara down to San Diego, off to right outside of California. And during some of the excavations, he said he excavated or was able to find or found several 9-foot skeletons. And of course, that's interesting.
But he found 9-foot skeletons on Catalina?
Yeah. Yeah, what piqued my interest...
What time frame was this?
This is 1919.
Okay, back before the cloud set in.
Well, the cloud was already setting in. That's part of the problem, because we've got reports from all over the country where, 8, 9, 10, 12-footers were being found, and then they were literally bundled up and whisked away, never to be seen again. What was interesting is...
Was this by the Smithsonian?
Yeah.
They're the bad guys in this story, yes.
Yeah, they are. Fritz Zimmerman's written extensively on it. In On the Trail of the Nephilim, Volume 1, one of the researchers, a guy by the name of Micah, sent me about 250 newspaper clippings from all over the country. Out of the 250, I cherry-picked 50. My editor narrowed it down to 25, and those are the ones that we went with. Basically, the facts are there. I mean, it's indisputable. I mean, incontrovertible that giants, skeletons, were being exhumed out of these burial mounds all over the United States of America. And that's the basis of being on the trail 1 in Volume 2. Volume 2 deals with Catalina, getting back onto that. So I have dinner with Jim Watson, and I say, you know what, when did he do this, 1919, and do you have any evidence? Were there any pictures, any photos? And he goes, well, I don't have anything. But John Borregina, who happens to be the curator of the Catalina Museum, just discovered a cache of records in the Wrigley Theater. The museum still is on the bottom in the basement of the Wrigley Theater. And above that is a movie theater. And
On Catalina.
And so Borregina would show movies and he would run the projector as part of what his duties were, okay?
Okay.
He'd run the projector, and while the projector's going on a Wednesday night and there's, you know, two people in the audience, he's out there running around in the attic, rummaging around, and he happened to find a trunk way back in one of the corners under some who knows what. He opens it up, and it's the lost Ralph Glidden records. What a cache.
Oh, my gosh.
Archaeologists, anthropologists, everybody makes a beeline out there. And I get wind of this. And so it takes me 8 months to get permission to go out to Catalina to look at it.
Who did you have to get permission from?
The museum.
Okay.
And I donated $1,000 to be able to do that.
That helps.
Yeah, so that opened the door immediately. And I got to go in there. I met John, and Jim Watson lives on the island. So Jim and I had dinner, and then we went right over to the museum. I spent 10 hours in the museum not alone, but with John Borregina. The museum was closed after hours. We're in a little back room where the vault is, two tables. Some of this, by the way, is in our new film, Watchers 10. But they're bringing out the museum boxes. Everything's been cataloged. It's all in museum boxes and manila envelopes. Everything is put in folders, and the pictures that are there are plastic. And I've got white gloves on, my camera set up on the tripod. And John Borregina goes, well, what do you want to see? I want to see the pictures. So he hands me they get the box out of the vault. They bring the box out, and it's all of Ralph Glidden's pictures that they found. And what's interesting, Borregina, and I'll go ahead of myself here a little
bit. Were these kind of like Ansel Adam, 8x10?
Nothing nearly as good as that.
Oh, darn.
But they were good. And they're all, I published them in On the Trail of the Nephilim Volume 2. And so I was allowed to do that. What was interesting
Could we find one of those and stick it up on Other Side of Midnight tonight? Because, talking about giants and giant skeletons without showing them really makes our audience unhappy.
Go to, you want me to try to send you one?
No. Have M do it.
Okay.
Just send her a link if you can in Skype, and then she'll get it over to Keith, okay, and we'll get it posted. Because I want to see what a real bona fide skeleton of a giant looks like.
Yeah, go to my website. It's right there. And she'll be able to pick it off of that.
That's what Radio of Pictures is all about.
Give me a second.
Okay.
.net. And go to On the Trail.
Yeah, just post it there in Skype, and he'll pick it up.
Yeah, she's got it.
Okay.
Okay, so Borregina told me later on that some of the pictures went missing.
Oh?
Yeah. Some of the pictures went missing, and he doesn't know how or why or under what circumstances.
Between the time that they found them and they were then cataloged and you got to see them, something lifted some of them.
Some of the pictures were missing. So, but I'm in there, and I've got a set of lens on my eyes. I'm looking for giants. I'm looking for elongated skulls. I'm looking for six fingers. That's what I'm looking for.
Mm-hmm.
I find Pay Dirt, which is published in On the Trail of the Nephilim Volume 2. It was also the work that I did was also picked up by the History Channel, specifically for the Vieira brothers, their season finale, In Search of a Lost Giants. I actually had, let me back up. We found elongated skulls, we found six fingers, and we found Ralph Glidden, who was 5'8" tall, in a recently excavated tomb. And in front of him is a very large character. And hopefully she'll be able to post that up, because it's there on the site. Just go to On the Trail 2 in the book when it says read more and go. And there's a whole, you should be able to just lift it from there. So I had four different people examine the picture. Number four wrote me back within 24 hours and said, I've analyzed the photograph. There's absolutely no evidence of Photoshop. It is genuine. It's the real thing. Okay, so we established that. But
if they only examined it, they're examining actual pictures, or they're examining pictures of pictures?
They're examining my picture of the picture.
Ah, because they didn't have original data, so they couldn't tell about emulsions.
No way I can take the picture out of the museum. Mm. But I took pictures of it.
No
skullduggery, no Photoshop, nothing like that.
Hang on a sec. Has the museum done the proper forensic analysis to prove that the pictures, the prints, are as old as we think they could be?
They are as old as, well, let me put it this way. The science, as far as I know, has not been done, but all the forensic evidence is there. For instance, the pictures, 1919, I mean, it's the real deal, in my opinion. I mean, they are what they are. And they're all in these little museum boxes hidden away from the public. So the other three men were able to take the photograph based on Ralph Gooden's 5'8" height and move it, create everything digitally on their computers, and then from that extrapolate the height of the skeleton. They all put it just under 9 feet.
Okay.
And that's not supposed to be there.
Well, no, of course not.
It's not supposed to be there. Then I found another skeleton who was also 9 feet with 6 fingers. And what's interesting, that ties back to the Native American oral tradition of red-haired, six-fingered giants running around. So it lends veracity to their oral tradition. But it also ties back, once again, to the biblical prophetic narrative, which talks about the six-fingered giants, the Nephilim. We know that they were there. So those are just some of the stories, that we actually uncovered. I mean, that's real hard work on my part. I mean, it's real evidence. And it's, things are analyzed, and the photographs were analyzed, and here it is. So I can't get more scientific than that. There it was. And I'll just give you a clincher to the story, which is just incredible, absolutely incredible. We went back to the island about 8 months after the book was published, and we walked into the museum, and there's the picture on the wall blown up, but the giant was cropped out of the picture.
Ah, you're kidding.
I'm not kidding, and that's all in Watchers 10. We're gonna show that. I weigh in on it. I'm giving you kind of a scoop here.
What about all the rest of the evidence?
Well, the rest of the evidence is in the book. They have it there.
So it's still at the museum?
Yes. Look, it's just like the elongated skulls that I found pictures of. That's not supposed to be there. Elongated skulls, and one of them I found, Richard, looked very similar to an artifact that we found in Peru. Very similar, and I do in AB. And of course, Peru is thousands of miles away. So this lends credence to my hypothesis that there's an outside agency manipulating the human genome to its own ends.
Okay. I had an anthropologist on the other night, Maria Wheatley, and she was discussing skulls and finds in Britain.
Yes, Stonehenge.
Stonehenge and the surrounding barrows and all that. Yes. She says there are two main types. There's the round heads and there's the elongated skulls.
Mm-hmm.
So it'd be interesting to compare the parameters of the elongated skulls that they've got there with the ones you've now found, in Catalina?
Well, in Catalina, but there's also, I want to get into this, in Peru we found elongated skulls. And I talked to Brian Forrester about this. I also emailed Maria Wheatley about it. What she was talking about was that these elongated skulls, many of them were buried, and the skulls show signs of blunt force trauma to the left side of the head, which means a right-handed person is hitting them with a war club or some such object to create a fracture in the skull. We went, the last time we were in Peru, to a place called Camacho. It's a very, very otherworldly place. Very, very strange. It feels like you're walking on the moon. It's an ancient salt bed, and the salt has just picked up into these like shields, for lack of a better word, that are just haphazardly placed. And as you walk, they just crumble beneath your feet. Nothing grows there because it's all salt. And we went on top of this. We finally reached the top of this hill, and there's a mass grave there. And it's a killing field. There's no honor in these burials. There's no pottery or ornaments or anything like that. It's a killing field. And all the skulls, and this is unbelievable, Richard, all the skulls were elongated, and they all showed blunt force trauma to the left side of the skull.
Okay.
Separated thousands of miles from Stonehenge. And it begs the question, isn't that interesting? you know, that we're seeing the same type of eradication of the elongated skulls. We have the skulls being found in the burrows around Stonehenge of that have great elongation.
So do you think these were ceremonial killings, ritual killings?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. And one species against another?
Yeah, what it is, and again, this dives back with my hypothesis, the Nephilim, the mandate comes down to wipe the Nephilim out. And that's what Joshua and Caleb, when they go into the Promised Land, that's what's going on there. Their Nephilim tribes are there. And so the Nephilim tribes, they flee. Some go northward into Europe. Others hop on papyrus boats. And Thor Heyerdahl proved this in his book, Raw. You wind up in Barbados. And the rest is history. And I think that's our hypothesis. And if that's the case, then we should find evidence of it. And we do. In Watchers 10, we're revealing some really interesting tie-ins with what we've discovered and how, you know, we're just continuing down the trail and getting more and more information, more and more data. One object, which I talked about in On the Trail of the Nephilim, Volume 2, was what we call what we've come to call the Nephilim Lance. I have a picture of it in the book, but I also have a replica of it 2 feet away from me now. It's a bronze object. It's almost 3 feet long. It weighs about 8.5 pounds. It's not a sword. You can't use it as a sword. It's a lance. And for someone to use a lance like that, you're looking at someone well over 9 feet. And the providence of that, Richard, it was found at an abandoned campsite in Michigan. We have had the metal tested, and that in itself was a very interesting day, and I wrote about that. It'll come in with the new book, which will come out in a few months, called Nephilim Hybrids.
Is it an alloy?
It's copper and tin.
Copper, okay.
Yeah, bronze.
Okay, but I thought there might be other interesting things in there.
That's what we asked. I spent $2,000 to analyze the material, and when we first went there and presented the artifact, which we never should have done, because we tipped our hand. We should have just said, "Hey, what can you identify this?" We were told that yes, we can identify probably where the copper is, and maybe even give you an age as to how old this thing was. When we got back there,
how could they do an age on an artifact made of metal?
I don't know, but that's what the tech said. She said by the way the metal is I guess cooked or heated or the way it looks, I have no idea, but they said we might be able to date it for you.
Well, they may have been looking at, you know, because there are certain metal shaping cultures that had certain periods, like in you know, the samurai swords and all that.
Right, sure.
So they were probably looking for something that would be recognizable. Then they'd say, okay, those guys did it, and they lived 3,400 BC, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and of course, when we got back there to get the data, the tech was being ministered to, for lack of a better word, by a PR person from the company. And we were not allowed to photograph. We were not allowed to use her name. All these stipulations, which weren't in place before, were now in place.
Oh, so, that's such a familiar pattern.
Yeah.
Over the years, we've gotten all kinds of interesting people excited about our Mars work. And, you know, 3 days later, Richard who?
Yeah.
So. We're still waiting, by the way, for the skull image to appear on Other Side of Midnight and Radio with Pictures. We don't need all of them. We just need one. And if there's one with a comparison so we can actually see the scale, that would be very useful. L.A.?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so let's look at, again, we're talking evidence. You talked about the evidence of really amazing things in Catalina. Let's move to Ohio, where the next major primary next week is going to occur. And you have an image there of Serpent Mound at a place called Newark, Ohio. And to me,
here's something really interesting with the Serpent Mound. And this also is in the new book. I'll sort of tip my hand here. Why the serpent? And there's a wonderful aerial footage that someone took recently with a drone. You got to love the drones, because now we can get the GoPros up there and you can really see the bird's eye view.
Absolutely.
And I have a I have a pamphlet in my hot little hands here from 1924 about the Great Serpent Mound, which is incredible. And the guy's, you know, talking about this thing, and all the backstory is all in the book. But the reason why I included the Serpent Mound in this book, and I've been to the Serpent Mound and walked it and seen it, and it's very impressive. And it's always the serpent. Isn't that funny? No matter where you go, it's always the serpent. Mm-hmm. But the serpent seems to be, depending on who you talk to, doing something with an egg, giving birth to an egg. And we look at this from my particular paradigm when we go back to the Genesis 3 biblical prophetic narrative, which states the seed of the woman will be at enmity. The seed of a serpent will be at enmity with the seed of the woman. Mm-hmm. The seed of a serpent will be at enmity with the seed of the woman, the egg. And what we think is happening here, because what we believe is that the seed of the woman becomes Messiah. And the seed of the serpent mound is, depending on who you talk to, which archaeologist, 3,000 years old, others put it much, much earlier. I'm going with the 3,000-year-old date, but many archaeologists put it around that time.
What's the oldest date for it?
It's about between 3,000 and 4,000 years.
So that's the oldest canonical date?
Yeah.
Okay. I thought you said it might be older.
No, that's where I place it. I place it between 3,000 and 4,000 years.
Okay.
What's interesting, and this has never been talked about before, because no one's approached the Serpent Mound that I'm aware of with this paradigm. What we believe, and I've written a paper on this, it'll be published in the book, but it's also being published in Prophecy Watchers news magazine, I think this month or maybe next month.
Should we be looking at image 4, 5, and 6 on Radio with Victor's?
Definitely 4. That's the Serpent Mound.
Okay.
5 is the Great Circle Mound.
Okay. Well, these are very close by, right?
Very well. No, Serpent Mound's about 3 hours away.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, but they're all connected, in my opinion.
Okay.
So here's the punchline, Richard. We believe the serpent is trying to swallow the egg. Trying to destroy the egg, trying to eat the egg.
Well, that's what it looks like in the effigy. The egg is in the mouth of the serpent.
I agree.
That's not contested. See, the symbolic meaning is what's hanging out there, but the actual data is not really contestable because you have this wonderful, incredible, huge. How long is the serpent mound and how high?
It undulates. It's not that high. It's funny. When I look at the pictures, I was expecting something, you know, 20, 30 feet high. It's not. It's about 4 to 5 feet high, but, you know, at its apex. I believe, I'm so bad with numbers. It's very long.
Is it a football field?
It's very long. At least a football field, yes.
Okay. Now, I seem to remember some other guys did some research on astronomical alignments with the serpent mound.
They're there. And again, Native Americans did not look at solstices and equinoxes. They just didn't travel on this. It's not a derogatory statement. It's just a fact. I mean, you know, they just
Although the guys at Chaco Canyon did.
And that's another conversation.
This is northwest of me here.
Who invents Chaco Canyon? Who were the Anasazi? Mm. You know, who... It gets back into another site, the oldest site in the Americas, called Corral, which is 3 hours north of Lima. It's over 5,000 years old. Where does the advanced mathematics, the geometry, the building technique, the engineering come in for all these sites? You know, where is the knowledge coming from? And in my hypothesis, in my worldview, it's coming from extraterrestrial, but
there are two parallel routes. One is yes, ET contact. The other is our great 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 grandmothers. In other words, we're looking at legacy cultures, as Graham talks about them, mm-hmm. and we've forgotten, or we have deliberately forgotten, our ancient past, our own ancestors, the things we used to do, the knowledge we used to have, and we're now living in, as I said, very primitive times. Even though we have lots of gadgets, we know almost nothing of how things really work.
Well, you know, everybody has a different way of looking at things and a different paradigm.
So you don't buy the idea that we're looking at ancient terrestrial culture.
I don't mean from Zeta Reticuli. I mean interdimensional entities, fallen angels, in my opinion.
Okay.
That's the source.
Okay. Well, everybody's model is appropriate, and the way we sort it out is with the evidence. Right?
Yep.
Okay, so what's number six? Because number six is the one that I wanted to kind of talk about, because that connects to another set of data that I talked with Maria just the other night about.
That's the Great Circle Mound, which connects to the Octagon.
The Octagon, yes.
Yep. And the Octagon is incredible. It's huge. You can actually fit the Great Pyramid inside the Octagon Mound. I was just there fairly recently. It's now a private golf course, and
Don't tell me it's run by somebody that we know.
No, it's not.
It's not him. Okay.
Donald has nothing to do with it. But it's
couldn't resist.
I was torn between.
They made this a golf course.
I'm sorry. What?
They made this site a golf course.
Yeah, I was torn between. Here's the one underneath. That's incredible. The last one. Between concentrating on my game and studying the mounds, because they're absolutely incredible. And again, the Octagon Mound, we believe it's based on an 18.6-year lunar cycle. And all these sites were totally connected, completely connected. And it's a question, where's the infrastructure that supports a culture to do something like this? Because you just don't wake up on a Monday morning, like we talked about Baalbek earlier. Hey, let's carve some 1,800-ton stones and move them. Yeah, it sounds like a good idea.
Nothing else to do this morning. Okay, Keith's got the link up to your slideshow, the elongated skull slideshow. I'm clicking on it now. And that takes you, I think, to your site. And then we scroll down. Oh, and there's the comparison. Oh, my God, look at these.
And the one on the right is human. The one on the left came from Peru.
You mean the first one? Yeah, because the slideshow. Can we stop the slideshow? Can we go back and make it pause? It appears to be on automatic.
It is on automatic, yeah.
Okay, so let me just go back and look at the first one. Because the first one that comes up, you've got, as I said, the side-by-side comparison. Do we know where it says the Parca skull versus normal human skull? What is the Parca skull?
It's the Parca skull.
Parca, I'm sorry.
Yeah, the Parca skull is the one on the left with the reddish brownish hair,
right?
Which is greatly elongated, and we're working on that. It's in a private museum, Señor Juan Navarro's private museum in Paracas, Peru. We've measured that. We've had an archaeologist down. It's got 25 to 35% more cranial capacity than a normal human skull. The big deal here is...
So these guys were brighter?
Well...
I mean, our average human skull is supposed to be, what, 1,400 cc's?
Yeah, it's far beyond that. It's far beyond that.
This is an excellent slideshow. I recommend everybody click on the link. Oh, there's one of Brian sitting in a weird chair, and there's the barrows and the mounds. Oh, yeah, this is really cool. But, yeah, the skulls are there. Look at them at your leisure. Now people can kind of, you know, take it in at their own pace. But this is extraordinary. And yet this information, you say, has been systematically suppressed.
Well, I mean, look, I'm on your show and we're talking about this. And it doesn't matter whether we, you know, agree to disagree. That's fine. The point is we're talking about it. We're getting the evidence out, which needs to be done. Something's going on here. And in my opinion, as I stated before, there's an outside agency that's messing with the human genome, to just put it quite bluntly. Something's going on. The other side of the aisle, what I mean by that, academics will insist that all these skulls have been cradle headboarded. Our rebuttal of that is, yes, some of them certainly are. We get that. Some of them are cradle headboarded. But why get up on a Monday morning and say, hey, Junior, we're going to make you a conehead today? What are they trying to emulate? And why is it that cone heads
terrific.
Skulls are all over the world.
Sorry, Keith has now posted just above your music link, right under the other images and the books we're going to get to shortly, a side-by-side comparison, a side view. And you say that elongated skull is not boarded. It is natural.
This was a skull that came out of Peru. It's in a private collection in Oregon. We were able to take DNA sampling from it. It is being tested as we speak. Look at the brow ridge. Let's walk through this a little bit.
I tell you what, let's walk through it after the bottom of the hour.
That sounds good.
We're at the break, and I don't want to truncate this. This is really intriguing.
No truncating, please.
Please, no truncating. Okay. my guest this morning, L.A. Marzulli, we're discussing... Well, the fact that we're discussing guys that don't look like us, buried side by side with us, and where are the guys that now don't look like us? Where'd they go? We'll try to get to some of those answers on the other side. This is More Bright, All Bright this evening. There's a message there. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return.
So close to you, the world is fine. So close to you, must be something in it. You're taking over my time, but that's fine by me.
And we are back, and as I expected, people are calling and wanting to join the conversation. If you'll hold off for a few minutes, we're going to open the lines, but I want L.A. to get to a certain stopping point, because without the context, questions might not be mean as much as they will after. I'm looking at this at the skull image that Keith was able to post, and it seems to me that the human guy on the right has had a tree panning operation.
Yeah, both of these were found. This man's grandfather was a medical doctor. And so
the guy who has this private collection.
Yeah. And it's just, he only has three skulls that was bequeathed to him by his grandfather. The skull on the right is a normal, modern human being. And yeah, it looks like he had trepanation, done to the front, but we really don't know. But that the entire skeleton was actually of this particular individual was in a box. The reason why we used it, in this photograph was to A-B it, because what we're looking at, and let's just kind of walk through it, look at the jaw, or what is called the mandible.
Mm.
And the one on the left, the one that is a museum piece that's been shellacked, look how robust it is, much larger. Then right where the jaw hinges itself to the skull, that little ridge there is called the zygomatic arch. Look how elongated and how robust the zygomatic arch is compared to a normal human being. Directly above the eye is called the brow ridge, and that's where the frontal plate of the skull attaches itself, okay? Mm-hmm. And when we look at that, look at the human being where the brow ridge is, and they have a forehead. It's very plain. You can see it on the right. The skull on the left, the brow ridge basically goes back at a 45-degree angle. You can't do that. You can't cradle board an infant's head like that. You'll kill it. I mean, you just can't. And then, of course, it goes even further back. Again, we were allowed to take samples of this, and we are doing DNA testing on it as we speak.
When do you think you might have results?
It'll be out in Watchers 10.
I love it.
Probably 2 to 3 months.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, very, very soon.
Yeah, are you familiar with the work of on the Starchild skull?
Yes, I am. Lloyd Pye, sure.
Yeah, poor Lloyd. Again, a guy who should be with us because we're getting to the good stuff. Well, no, there's no way that's cradle-boarded. And the size of the mandible, the size of the jaw, and the everything says robust, robust, robust. Mm-hmm. So, all right, let's speculate wildly in the last 20 minutes of the show. Who were these guys?
Well, again, the hypothesis that we're using, there are many different Nephilim tribes. There's just not the Nephilim, the Raphaim, the Zamzumim, the Emims. These are all names, and these names, when you go and research them, have certain point to, like the Anakim, long necks. That points to a genetic characteristic. So we know that there's giants, because we found nine-footers on Catalina. We know that there's elongated skulls running around. The giants on Catalina, the skull was huge, and we also found elongated skulls in Catalina. So the hypothesis is 3,500 years ago, as Joshua and Caleb are going into what is known as the Promised Land, and this, my friend, is a three-hour conversation. It really is. It's just not going to happen in 20 minutes. But the bottom line is there's a mandate to wipe all these guys out who are living there from the God of the Bible. And that's genocide by any stretch of the imagination. That's what it is. Unless the entities that are there are hybrid beings that are soulless, that were never supposed to be here in the first place. And this gets into the whole, my view, my paradigm of the cosmic war, the cosmic chess match, which is ongoing, which has been going on literally for millennia and is beginning to spill out over onto the planet in ways that I've never seen, including the introduction of hybrid beings, which we're getting reports of. So the hypothesis is that Joshua and Caleb went into what is known as the Promised Land, and these entities fled. They fled northward into Europe. They built boats, and we talked about this before the break. You know, Thor Heyerdahl proved this with Ra. You can build a papyrus boat, sail out the Mediterranean, you wind up in Barbados without doing anything. No compass. The trade winds will take you there. Mm-hmm. And guess what? We find giants all through the Americas. We find elongated skulls all through the Americas. And it seems to point to a mystery race. And it seems to point back to, and, you know, we've got some DNA evidence here, which we're going to be releasing. I can't talk about it, which I believe will bolster our hypothesis. So we'll see.
Now, you've hung out a lot with Brian. I'm trying to get Brian on, but he keeps telling me, oh, you're on too late. I got to tape, you know, that kind of thing. So Brian may not grace these airways for a little while, but he's done some stunning work in South America. Have you been to Pumapunku?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
That's obviously the remnants of a destroyed, very sophisticated, high-tech civilization.
Yep.
And it was destroyed. It didn't just kind of fall into ruin. It was destroyed.
I agree. Just like Ollantaytambo. I agree.
Was that destruction part of this mandate to get rid of these guys?
I think that Pumapunku is pre-flood. I think Sacsayhuaman is pre-flood. Ollantaytambo is pre-flood. The Circle Mound, the Serpent Mound, is post-flood.
Mm-hmm.
Difference. And isn't it interesting, even the biblical prophetic narrative, after the flood, you know what it says? There's a little throwaway line. They built with brick, not stone. Whoa!
Mm.
What does that mean? Exactly.
Okay, next question. Are you familiar with the work of Carl Munk?
Oh, that rings a bell.
I asked Maria the other night, and she had the same reaction. You guys, obviously, are working together. You guys are going to really be thrilled with this. Carl, who's a longtime friend of mine, when I wrote Monuments, you know, there's a lot of numbers and measurements and whatever in Monuments. And so I used to get a lot of mail. Or this is before email. Can you imagine before email and texting?
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, primitive. Anyway, so I would get these letters, and I would sit in this farmhouse, you know, in Virginia, western Virginia, out by Kentucky.
Oh, wow.
And I would read on this wonderful 164-acre farm, I would read all these letters. And, you know, you love fan letters. In those days, people really wrote letters. Now they, you know, send you an email. Anyway, this one letter really jumped out at me because this guy, this unknown guy, had all the right numbers. And science is based on numbers. As Eddington said, if you don't have a science gentleman, unless you can express it in numbers. This guy, Carl Munk, totally unknown to me, had the right numbers. So I called him up. And then he started sending me stuff. And it turns out that Carl has been looking at ancient sites, native sites, aboriginal sites, all over the planet. And he has found they're all connected by these numbers, the geometry. The you know, the octagon at Newark is connected through this exquisite number system to Stonehenge, and that's connected to Tikal, and that's connected to the thigh bone, and that's connected to, you know, that kind of thing. So there was this global meta-knowledge net.
Yes.
But the knowledge was expressed from very sophisticated, very ancient stuff built out of stone,
yes,
like we see at Baalbek, all the way to the mounds by the Ohio River, which were demonstrating the same physics and knowledge, but they were expressing it in the technology of their day, which had decayed and devolved so much, all they could do was pile up the earth. But the numbers, the mathematics, the knowledge of these incredibly disparate cultures in terms of sophistication was the same. A global system knit together with a grid which is so incredibly accurate that we can't even do it using GPS now.
In On the Trail 1 and 2, I talk about America's Stonehenge, which is a site that's about 35 to 4,000 years old. Again, a henge is a circle, and this is a classic henge. It also has a sacrificial table on it, which allows for bloodletting. There's also a hidden room underneath it. But what's intriguing to me about it, yeah, the Georgia guy stones.
Mm.
What's intriguing to me about America's Stonehenge is this, that there's from the center of the henge, there's a summer solstice standing stone. There's also a winter solstice standing stone and all the equinoxes and then everything else in between.
You don't mean this concrete replica of Stonehenge up in Oregon, do
you? No. This is America's Stonehenge in New Hampshire.
Oh, okay.
It's a fascinating place. I've written about it. So Kelsey Stone goes on Google Earth and he goes, I wonder what happens if I draw a line from the center of my henge in New Hampshire out to our summer solstice standing stone. So he does, to see what happens. He draws the line on Google Earth. He extends the line further and further and further and further. He winds up, get this, hold your breath. It's all in the book, by the way. Mm-hmm. He winds up splitting the center trilithon in Stonehenge.
Fantastic.
You can't do that in antiquity.
Well, you shouldn't be able to.
You shouldn't be able to, but you do.
But
and you've
got
to be in
did.
The air to do it. You know that, Richard. You've got to be in the air to do it.
Well, see, again, are we looking at an ET intersection with our civilization, our human species, or are we looking at ancient human knowledge passed down, made sacred, made ceremonial, so it's preserved? So ultimately, all the externals are there, the right mathematics, the right alignments and all that, but the knowledge of what it does is now missing.
Well, again, I would default back to the biblical narrative or the Book of Enoch, which talks about the secrets of heaven were given by these watchers, by these fallen watcher angels, which came and corrupted everything. And you're right. Here's something to think about, and we're getting close to the top of the hour. I want to get this in if I can. You know, what future holds to mankind, okay?
Yep.
And here it is. We're told in an ancient prophecy that'll be like the days of Noah when the Son of Man returns. Remember, this is almost a 2,000-year-old prophecy. It'll be like the days of Noah when the Son of Man returns, which immediately turns the biblical student to, well, what the heck's so different about the days of Noah? What we find is that the Nephilim are on the earth. That's what we find. And there's this contamination of the human genome. Only 8 people were saved. Everybody else gets wiped out because everybody else has become Nephilim or part of this thing somehow. But we also go back, and this is where the Sacsayhuamán-Ollantaytambo, Pumapunku, there was a grid system. You spoke of it. There was a grid system. And I believe that grid system was used in a malevolent way towards the human race. I believe it was used to enslave the human race. Now, I could be wrong in that.
When I have you back, which we will, I'm going to argue really strenuously that, in fact, it's exactly the opposite, and there's some natural background that you would need to know to have that conversation. Can we start taking some of these callers because they're orbiting?
Let me just get to the punchline
right.
Real quick.
Let me bring mute your mic, whoever you are, and we'll let L.A. finish, and then we'll bring you on. Go ahead.
Okay. So here's the deal. In modernity, the grid system is back. Right now, it's benevolent, but the grid is back.
How is the grid back?
Well, the grid's back with the World Wide Web, with the cashless society, with the fact that we're being chipped and sprayed and everything else.
That's kind of an extended metaphor.
This dovetails right into the biblical narrative, which talks about this implant. And this is like another show. But this is our work in Watchers 7 and Watchers 8, where we took the implant out of somebody who had been abducted. But I don't have enough time to really get into it. The grid's back, and it'll be used, not now, but it'll be used to enslave, just like it was thousands of years ago.
Hmm. Well, if you define the grid in terms of what you just said, I would kind of maybe – I see a lot of negatives, and look at how the loss of privacy and how people –
Right.
What's worse than the loss of privacy, L.A., is people are getting used to it. It's like
we are
getting used to the cacophony of absurdity and the descent of the Republican primary system into chaos just because it's present. It's on television. It's like, oh, I guess it's just part of our culture devolving in front of our eyes. The internet, the web, all the, you know, the cashless society, the mark of the beast, all that is totally different than the grid that Monk found, because the grid that Monk found, some pieces of which I've now been able to measure with our technology, which we'll describe when you come back,
okay,
I think was meant to uplift human consciousness. In fact, I will make a great case that this was a desperate effort to keep us from devolving. And part of the reason we are devolving almost in front of our eyes is because the physics has changed and it no longer is what it once was, and we no longer can get in contact with who we really are.
Interesting.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. We have a caller. Let's call a pregnant pause caller. Who are you and where are you calling from?
We don't want to allow dead air on the show.
Oh, never, never.
My name is Ryan.
That's the worst thing you should ever have.
Ryan, I'm up in Washington. Ryan here.
I'm sorry. Brian?
Yeah.
Okay, Brian. Ryan. What would you?
Yeah.
Ryan. Brian or Brian?
Yeah. I've talked to you before.
Okay.
Ryan. I talked to a lady once who lives in Peru. And she had an encounter with somebody or something that was, it shook her world. It was, let me just make it quick because we're almost out of time. But there are accounts of people who still encounter today tall, extremely tall people that don't seem, they seem out of place. And I'm talking about in that, but deep in the jungles of South America, Peru, and everywhere else. L.A., have you had any reports of people encountering tall giants today?
Great question.
It's a great question, and thanks so much for calling in, Brian. I appreciate it. Here's the deal. All I can tell you, I can just say yes to that. I can't really get into it because all of this is in Watchers 10 in a new book, and we will release it within the next 2 or 3 months. I can't believe myself the stuff that's in this. and basically, it's just yes to your question. But you'll read about it and see about it, and I'll be talking about it like crazy in a couple of months.
L.A., you are a master salesman. Okay.
Well, you gotta eat. You gotta keep the lights on. You gotta get money to go to Peru.
Exactly. Research. People think research is just done because you sit in front of your computer and you Google. No.
Wrong.
No. Wrong. Okay.
Wrong.
We have our next caller. Good morning, and where are you calling from?
This is Joe from Arkansas.
Hi, Joe. Oh my God, do you have an umbrella?
No, it's a cell phone.
You're getting a lot of rain down there tonight.
Oh, yeah. I just got two quick questions for him, and I'll take my answers off the air. One's on the reincarnation, that, you know, he doesn't believe in it. I wonder what he thinks about the message when Christ tells him that his disciples, that John the Baptist was Elijah, come if they would accept it, which is reincarnation. And secondly, do you think Christ was here for us to exalt him, or was he here to tell us who we were? And I'll take my answers off the air.
Again, great questions.
Great questions. Well, when he talks about Elijah, he's saying, you know, you can make a case, and I've heard this before. People say, well,
get a little closer to your mic, please.
Yeah, no problem. That's proof of reincarnation. It's not proof of reincarnation. Because if you actually read the text, it says in the spirit of Elijah. So, you know, and I get how things like that can be taken out of context, in my opinion. So it's in the spirit of Elijah. That's how Yeshua answers. Yeshua came, and this is, again, another 3-hour conversation. it gets into the idea of a cosmic war, that there was something that happened, and he came, and people don't understand the work of Calvary. And when he is on Calvary, when he's on the cross, first of all, when they come to get him, think about this. They ask, who, you know, where are you, Jesus of Nazareth? And he says, I am. And they all fall back. He doesn't have to go, but he lays his life down willingly. The miracle of what happened 2,000 years ago and continuing into modernity is this, that when we come to him who was sent, which is Yeshua, which is Jesus, and we confess that we are depraved, that we do stuff that we don't like, we get eternal life. Don't ask me how that works, but that's the promise. And we are absolved of the nasties. And not only that, we begin to change. And I think our DNA changes. I think he begins to change our DNA. So that's what it is. And it ties back into this cosmic war, which has been going on, which will, by the way, is we're ramping up to it. We are ramping up, in my opinion, to a climax. I'm not a date setter, but this thing is ramping up in ways that I've never seen before. So that's
another point we agree on. It's accelerating. You know, Art had a phrase, the quickening.
Yeah, the quickening.
Boy,
sure.
Did he nail it.
He nailed it.
Okay. Lines are open. We actually have space. If you want to duck in here before the end of the hour, we've got about 7 minutes. Let's go back to your websites, and let's talk about where people can find out more information, because obviously 2 hours is nothing compared to the work you've done. I see three books listed here. Talk about the books.
Well, you know, I've written 9 books. Many of them are on the Nephilim. The trilogy is a novel. It's about 800 pages. There's 3 different books in that. You know, with our Watchers series, we've done 9 installments. Dr. Roger Lehr was in 8 of them before his untimely passing. And we used to have lunch with Roger. He was like everybody's favorite uncle. Mm. He was just fantastic. And we had wonderful conversations, and we miss him greatly. But, you know, Roger, we were on the trail with the whole implant thing. I mean, who gets to take out an implant? And we show all that on film. We do all the backstory, show exactly what happened. So, you know, the books, On the Trail of the Nephilim, Volume 1 and 2, I'm in Peru. I'm all over the place, really. You know, you mentioned Pumapunku and many of the places that we talked about, I'm there. It's boots on the ground. And what we found is absolutely astonishing. So, you know, and by the way, these books, On the Trail 1 and 2, are full-color books. You know, they're oversized books, 8.5 by 11.5, whatever. They're huge. And it's just every page or every other page has a picture on it, because I can talk about it, but when you see it with your own eyes, like when you see the elongated skull from Peru on your website, Richard, I mean, there it is. What do you do with that? And so that's what On the Trail 1 and 2 is about.
Now, the thing that I wanted to post, which was the skeleton, the 9-foot-tall skeletons, I don't think we got that up. Is it on your website?
It is, yes.
Okay. Can you tell us where? Because I was kind of scrolling.
If you go to On the Trail of the Nephilim Volume 2, it should be right up there.
Okay. Is it part of the montage, the slideshow?
It should be, yeah.
Okay. So you just let the slideshow play past Brian in the giant stone chair, past the English mounds. That's a nice woodcut.
Try scrolling down to the – let me go online here. Hold on. Let me go check it out.
Because I see a lot of text, but I don't see images of the giant skeletons. And that would be interesting, because the comparison with a normal human – taken in 1919, that would be interesting to see. Okay, we got another person, another individual. Good morning. You're on the air. Who are you and where are you calling from?
Good morning, Richard. This is Cassandra in Texas.
Hi, Cassandra.
Hi. Forgive me. I really don't mean to seem disrespectful, but why is your guest yelling?
Probably because it's a microphone that doesn't work too well.
I wondered about that. I could hear him a room away.
Okay. Any comments, L.A.?
You know, I get excited, and I'm very passionate about what I believe in, and especially the research. And it might sound like I'm yelling right now, but I'm just talking in my normal voice.
Did you have something else to ask?
I stand where you stand, Richard, as far as beliefs. Your name slips my tongue.
L.A.?
L.A., yes. Forgive me, but you know, when you start throwing labels and calling and saying this is the devil and that is the devil and it so much falls under this big huge umbrella called Satanism. I'm sorry, but I'm a goddess worshiper, and I have been for most of my life, and I had that calling since I was even younger than that. And there is no Satan in there, because we never believed in that little Christian creation to begin with. You have to be a Christian in order to believe in the devil to start with. If you're going to invest a thought form a thought form with energy, you have to believe in that thought form to begin with.
So what do we do with Jeffrey Dahmer?
Jeffrey Dahmer is not a thought form. Jeffrey Dahmer is a societal problem.
No, no, my dear, he's not. We differ on that, and I respectfully disagree with you. By the way, Richard, the giant is in the slideshow.
Oh, excellent. Cassandra, let me just say something in defense of L.A. I've noticed several times tonight, and it wasn't prompted, that he said, in my opinion. And that's the reason he's on the show, because he's not insisting this is the word of God. That's his belief. But he's not insisting the rest of us believe what he believes. He's presenting data. He's giving us an openness, a space to come to our own conclusions. He's giving us evidence that he wants to move us in the direction of his conclusion. But he's not mandating it as you have to believe this or else you'll all go to hell.
Bingo.
I understand that, Richard. But try and listen to him from the perspective of a woman who has listened to many, many, many men saying the very same things.
Okay, well, since we only have 30 seconds left in the show, can we agree right now to disagree respectfully?
That's what you got to do.
Of course.
Okay.
Of course.
Cassandra, thanks for calling, but I have to wrap things up before the next time we do all this. L.A., I want to thank you so much for being on the show. I didn't quite know what to expect. I find a guy who's open-minded, a guy who's scientific, a guy who has a particular perspective and a belief, but who respects other people's approaches, and that's all you need to play in the sandbox, because you have admitted that we all really don't know almost anything.
That's it.
And that's the position of humility that a good Christian should maintain, because the world is incredibly diverse and complex, and we all have different backgrounds. And as Rodney King once said, why can't we just get along? And on that note...
It's been great. I hope to come back on. There's lots to talk about. Good luck with the show, and we'll speak again soon.
Thank you. Well, guys, another edition of The Other Side of Midnight. Tomorrow morning, same time, same station. Don't be... As he used to say, be there or be square. So until tomorrow morning, just keep remembering, third star on the left, straight on till morning. Good night, everyone.